I'm a passionate region woman because I believe that your geography is not an obstacle to your success.
I'm a passionate regional woman because to me, regional WA is real and raw.
My work gives me the opportunity to travel all over this incredible state and to meet the most amazing people, for which I'm incredibly grateful.
It's all those personalities that make up our diverse communities. It's the people that make here a vibrant place to live.
I believe regional communities cannot achieve economic prosperity without talented regional women living in rural Australia.
It's what makes regional WA the best place to live and love. And that's why I'm a passionate regional woman.
The Triple R Network podcast by Generation Ag. We're your hosts, Kayla Evans and Lavinia Ware. How are you, Vinny?
Very well, thank you. How are you? Doing it via Zoom again?
Yeah, I'm actually, like, you know me, usually pretty high energy, but today I am absolutely shattered. This week has kicked my ass.
I feel like it's that time now, isn't it? We're in August. It's like the second half of the year is here. And because of things like harvest and all the other stuff going on, it's kind of, and then December's kind of a non-event month in terms of productivity. So I guess there's only 3 or 4 months left of actually getting stuff done. And COVID has put such a spanner in the works and we have so much on our plate. Do you want to talk a little bit about what exciting thing we have coming up?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, as if we didn't have enough to do already. So I don't know that we've ever really talked too much about ourselves on this on this format podcast, but Vinny and I both have full-time jobs. I work a pretty regular 9-to-5 and Vinny has her own business. She's a total boss babe. And yeah, on top of that, we do our regular podcast episodes on Mondays, and then we also every second week do this Triple R Network podcast. Mm-hmm. So we bite off a lot already. But to add to that, we're actually really excited because we're doing our very first event. And it's a virtual event, and we're excited to partner with another female-led organization in Big Ideas Rural. Mm-hmm. Did you want to share the listeners a bit about Big Ideas Rural?
Vin? Yeah, I love Big Ideas Rural. They have worked with the Triple R Network, so I'm sure many of you listening are familiar with them already. But they are an online membership platform that provides amazing workshops, training, meetups, education, resources, and so much more to women all around the country. And it's basically in rural areas. I mean, obviously you can be in the city and you can be part of it, but it's a special group of women who are trying to achieve phenomenal things and be successful in business in rural areas that may not have all the resources that they need. So Tori is behind it. She's amazing. You guys would know, we've spotlighted her before. And yeah, we're just very excited to be, the fact that they even reached out was amazing. They had a very successful virtual event before virtual events were even really a thing. Before COVID hit, it was very successful. So yeah, we're very excited, aren't we? And Kayla has been striving ahead in the last couple of weeks. She's been really getting us ahead. All the amazing graphics you've seen, she's a killer. So we're pretty excited.
Yeah, so that is our very first event, which is on International Rural Women's Day, which is the 15th of October. We haven't got an exact time locked in yet, so just put the whole day as a save the date. And the theme of the forum that we're running is Our Australia. And we're excited to do that theme because it means so much to different people and to rural women. Specifically, we experience our country very differently to women in the city who grew up in the city. So we felt like Our Australia is a great theme to celebrate diversity and what we want the future of you know, rural Australia to look like for women. And we're really excited to work with Big Ideas Rural and to have our very first event. So go and jump on. There's a Facebook event. You can obviously click interested, or if you want to commit, hit going. We would love to see you online on the 15th of October.
Absolutely. We're very excited. And with that, I guess we'll get into a little bit more about the Triple R Network. So it's rural, regional and remote women around Western Australia. And Kayla and I, this is really one of our passions. Obviously, this event we're holding is kind of all about this. So it's all about meeting like-minded women who develop ideas, connections, and become leaders in their community and are the voice on the ground for issues impacting women. And we're up to our 7th episode now, and the women and the calibre of these women that we've been able to talk to are all award-winning, phenomenal finalists of the AgriFutures Rural Women's Award. And it's just been an amazing opportunity, hasn't it?
Yeah, it truly has been. We say it every week again, but just to chat, it's such an honour, number one, a privilege to chat to these incredible women who are imparting their wisdom and knowledge with us and all of us. But we're super lucky because we actually get to spend just that little bit more time with them as well. And yeah, again, grateful to the Triple R Network for trusting us with this little project.
Absolutely. We're so, so blessed every day. So I'm going to get into the women of the week, and it's two women this week. And this has been a team of women that have come up a lot recently. They were featured on Big Ideas Rural Instagram, where I first learned about them. And then one of my girlfriends was actually touring their olive grove on her Instagram story the last week. And I was like, oh my gosh, these guys are legends. I've heard a lot about it. So it's Tarns and Roz, and they are the Toopin Rise Farming Olive Grove women, and they run this business that's situated 170 kilometres east of Perth in the wheat belt in Quiriding, next to the Toopin Weir. Sorry if I'm pronouncing anything wrong. So they actually only started the property in 2019, which is phenomenal. So they've got 3,000 irrigated olive trees and are surrounded by more than by their traditional farmland, and their groves are geographically elevated, providing the most magnificent vista and views. So in their first year, Kayla, they actually sold out of their oil, which is like unbelievable. So I just thought that these are amazing women doing powerhouse things, and I really enjoyed looking into their business a little bit more. And I think these are the women we're probably going to have to interview themselves, but I just thought it'd be worth doing an amazing shout out. And they also won a silver medal last year at the WA Olive Awards, which is also phenomenal.
That's awesome, and not that far away, so we have to go and visit.
I know, for sure. And Quiriding is somewhere you've wanted to go for a little while, so I think we're going to have to do a sneaky trip there.
Yeah, well, it's close to York too, which is just a lovely part of the world, so I'll be there anytime.
Absolutely. And then Kayla, you had the lucky opportunity of interviewing this week's guest, which I know you're very excited for. So can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, so I was a bit spoiled. I was excited to interview today's guest. And her name is Jackie Jarvis. And I'm sure if you're a West Australian woman in the Triple R Network or have any connection to the Triple R Network, you've heard of Jackie before. And that is because she actually was CEO of the Triple R Network. So many of you will know her. She has been an absolutely formidable woman in the West Australian agriculture industry, but representing women. And I was excited to interview her because I've actually worked with Jackie in a virtual capacity since the start of this year on a workforce project for the Department of Primary Industries, which was really exciting. So a little bit removed from my regular day job. And so it was just like, I've known Jackie since the start of the year, but never been able to actually say hi to her in person. And when you work so closely with someone and you haven't actually, you know, physically seen them face to face, I was really excited that I actually got to sit down with Jackie in person when she was visiting in Perth one weekend for her daughter's birthday. So I'm not going to say too much more about Jackie. I will let her talk about her career herself. You know, she won the Rural Women's Award before it was the AgriFutures Award. Like I said, she was an amazing, amazing representation for the CEO position of the Triple R Network. And she also has done some incredible work with placing refugees in agricultural work as well. So she's just got an incredible career and just an amazing story. So really excited to share hers with you today.
I can't wait to listen. Thanks so much, Kayla. And I guess we'll let them get into the episode.
Jackie Jarvis grew up in the northern Perth suburb of Wanneroo, where she spent her teenage years working on the vegetable-growing market gardens during her school holidays. After declaring to her family that she would never work in agriculture again, Jackie started her career in the finance industry, where she met her husband Matt while they were both working in the southwest. The couple relocated back to Perth and both got jobs in St George's Terrace, bought a house in the city with no plans to ever leave. But plans changed when, in 1996, Matt called her saying that he had been offered work for a transfer down to Margaret River, and Jackie agreed that she would go for 2 years. By 1998, the couple had sold their Perth home, had their first baby, planted a vineyard, and Jackie declared that she would never return to Perth. Jackie has had an incredible career. In 2004, she was named the winner of the Best Home-Based Export Business by the International Business Council of WA. In 2014, she was WA Rural Woman of the Year and National Runner-Up. More recently, Jackie has served as Principal Policy Advisor to the Honourable Alana McTiernan, Minister for Ag and Food. In November 2017, she took up the role as CEO for the Rural, Regional and Remote Women's Network of Western Australia, a role that allowed her to work from home on the vineyard, albeit with regular long-distance trips back to Perth. Whilst Jackie says she's not involved with the farm business so much anymore, she can regularly be found in the Jarvis Estate cellar door on the weekends, getting to know the tourists that pop in for one of their amazing Jarvis Estate drops. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Jackie.
Jackie Jarvis, welcome to the Triple R Network podcast recording with Generation Ag. Thank you so much for joining me on this bright and early Sunday.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm excited to talk to you in person because obviously we've had a working relationship for a few months now, all via Skype or Zoom in the life of COVID. So it's nice to meet you in person.
It is. It's kind of a bit weird. There's been this whole sort of weeks and weeks of, you know, Zoom meetings and meeting new people via Zoom. And it's, it's really interesting to finally get the same room as people.
Yeah, so cool. The first question we always ask is, tell us about yourself and also about your childhood.
Okay, so I grew up in Wanneroo in the northern suburbs of Perth. So my parents were immigrants. My mum was English, my dad's Irish. They came out to Australia in 1970 through the £10 POM program, so assisted package. And that was where Australia wanted more labourers, basically, and my dad was a builder's labourer. They had things hadn't been going great in the UK for them. They'd had a couple of bad winters. When you're a builder's labourer, when it's snowing, you don't get much work. So they decided to come to Australia, and we arrived in 1970, and I was a toddler. I was 18 months old. And when you arrived in Australia from the UK, you either moved to Rockingham or Wanneroo because they were the cheap suburbs on the outskirts of the city. And Wanneroo was really, it was really a bit like a country town then. Like, so it was still kind of the suburbs, but we were surrounded by vegetable gardens, commercial veggie growers. And so my mum had worked in factories in London, and when she was looking for part-time work, she started picking strawberries and then working for the neighbouring veggie growers. And so my after-school work was working with her, working on the veggie farms. So while my friends all sort of got jobs as checkout chicks at Coles, I was planting cauliflowers and capsicums with mum after school and on weekends, which swore me off anything to do with agriculture or horticulture. I swore I would never do anything getting my hands dirty ever again. And I actually got a job in banking. So I left school in the mid-80s, and there was a massive recession at the time, and it was really concerned, probably, you know, not dissimilar to what young people might be feeling at the moment, that you just weren't sure what the job market was going to hold. And so I made a decision not to go to uni. I had been thinking about going to uni and studying journalism, and in the start of year 11 I got offered a traineeship in a bank. So there was really, it was interesting time, because in the 80s I don't think we sort of thought of ourselves as feminists, because we kind of felt like that had been done in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so I think by the 80s we kind of went, oh no, it's all been sorted, which was so far from the truth, because, you know, to me it was a very small percentage of girls from Wanneroo High School, boys and girls actually, would have gone to uni. And for girls, we really felt like our options were secretarial college, a job in a bank, or potentially some of us might go to uni. And for boys, it's you went off and got an apprenticeship. And I hated typing, and I was really bad at typing, and I had a Scottish typing teacher called Mrs. Smith who I couldn't stand. And so I decided to go into banking so I didn't have to type. So I started my first job a week before my 16th birthday in a bank, and there was like a really formalised sort of trainee program where a whole cohort of us started, and spent a number of years working in banking in the city. And then it wasn't until my 20s I actually asked to go to the country, just sort of wanted to do something a bit different, went down to Busselton, and that's where I met my husband. So I met my husband then. And we actually had moved back to Perth. We were going to sort of build a life in Perth. He was working for another bank. I was working in the city. And one day he rang me, said, "I've been transferred down to the country." And I said, "I'm not going. We just bought a house in Perth." And he said, "Oh, it's Margaret River. It's a 2-year stint." He'd worked and lived in Bunbury and Busselton and Manjimup. And so we went to Margaret River in 1996. It was meant to be for a 2-year stint. And we loved it down there. We got married the year after. Our first daughter was born in 1998. By that stage, we'd sold our house in Perth, bought a block of land, and decided we were going to plant grapevines. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, that's amazing. Just stepping back a little, when you started out in banking, is that sort of where you saw your career going, or was that even something, a conscious sort of decision you were making at the time, that banking was going to be a career for you, finance was going to be a career?
Look, I think it was that, it started out, it was a job, you know, it's a good job. And as I said, we were, you know, the older listeners will remember that in the 80s, the interest rate was 17%. If you were buying a house, it was 17%. So it was kind of like, oh my God, you've got a good job. My parents were like, honestly, my mum thought I'd won the lottery. It was like, oh my God, you've got this really steady job in banking. And what banking did for me is gave me the opportunity to progress really quickly. So you start as a trainee, and then if you're really lucky, after a year you can be a bank teller, and then you can be a senior teller. And so if you worked hard in it, you could actually get pretty regular, and you know, every year, every 18 months you could progress up the chain and get a promotion. So I think I did see it as a long-term career, because it was what I knew. I think there's also an element of I can't really do anything else because I haven't been to uni. Mm-hmm. This is all I know. I wasn't any good typing. So I think there was also that element that you become a little bit institutionalised, that you go, what else would I do? Yeah. And it probably wasn't until we started planting vines, we'd bought the property, and I had children, that I kind of stepped out of that. And that was when, obviously, we were starting a business. I started doing the bookkeeping. In 2000 was when the GST came in, so all of the bookkeeping systems changed. So I had to sort of learn all that, and had two young children by that stage. And I think, like, I actually look back and I think that's probably one of the you know, great advantages if women choose to take a career break when they have their children. Sometimes it gives you time to take a step back and reflect and think about what you really want to do. So yeah, so I think I was just going to work in banking. My husband was in banking as well, and I think buying the property and actually going, no, let's do something different, was a bit of a leap of faith for us. So yeah. And it was really hard work early on, because Matt was working full time, and then, you know, ramming posts, vineyard posts, you know, after work and on weekends. We had our two eldest daughters. One was born in 1998, the year we planted the vineyard. The second was born in 1999. We waited a few years till we had the third one. But it was, like, when I look back, it was really, really hard work, but it really made us, and it gave us a whole new direction in life.
Talk to us a little bit more in depth about, you know, the decision to open a vineyard, or, you know, build one from scratch, essentially, because you had no experience, neither of you?
No. So what was interesting is what motivated us to do it is quite different to what motivates us now. Okay. So when we started, my husband was working in banking, but he wanted to do something physical. His grandfather had actually been from a farming background, but his grandfather had died before he was born. But there was sort of this family history. Grandfather's family had been dairy farmers, and then his actual grandfather had spent some time in the Swan Valley growing sultana grapes. And so there was a little bit of family history, but not that we ever knew. You know, we didn't have any connection in that his grandfather had died quite young. But Matt just wanted to do something, I think, sort of outside of banking, something on the land. He just really felt it would be of interest to him. At that time in the 90s, there was actually really good prices going as commercial grape growers, where you could be contract growers. Mm-hmm. So it was like, oh, you know, so it was a combination. He was an agribusiness bank manager. So he's going, oh, well, you know, these people are actually making good money and I really want to do something different. So he started planting vines, and when we bought the land, I was pregnant with our first child, and I think I was a bit like, oh, yeah, whatever, didn't really think it through. I just went, if that's what you can do, that'd be fun. You know, I think I was a little bit, my mind was focused on other things, funnily enough. And then we planted, the year we planted in 1998, vine plantings tripled in Margaret River. Mm-hmm. And it takes 5 years to get your first commercial crop. So you get some fruit after 3 years. But by the time we were ready to make wine, the whole wine market had collapsed. There was huge oversupply. So we got to 2002 and went, well, we're going to be picking grapes. No one's buying grapes. We better come up with a wine label, which is what we did. So, you know, we talk about COVID having to pivot. We had to pivot really quickly because we were only ever going to be, I guess, a commodity producer of grapes. Yeah. And by 2002, we actually were, you know, having to have wine labels made and produce wine. Mm-hmm. And then nothing motivates you like having a really, really big mortgage, so we'd borrowed heavily. And we would meet people our age, so at that stage, you know, in our 30s, we'd meet people the same age as us who were working in the winery, but then we'd find out that, you know, their dad was a cardiologist or orthopaedic surgeon. Yeah. We didn't know many other people that had actually, you know, sold their home to fund it. And we lived in rental accommodation for a number of years. We didn't end up moving out to the vineyard until, around about that same time, around about 2001, I think we moved out to the, so we were renting for the first few years. So it was really hard work and we kind of had to change and evolve. So we started making wine. We also started selling wine under some different labels because there was quite a lot of bulk wine around. So there was a bit of a wine glut. So there was a lot of wine sent in tanks where people had planted vineyards like us, mm-hmm. And didn't have a market for their wine. So we started doing a few things like selling other brands through auction houses. We knew we didn't want to, dilute the Jarvis Estate brand because we're really firm that that's single estate premium wines. But we could actually sort of source some other wines from other wineries and for cash flow purposes put it, you know, sell it through auction sites and stuff to keep the doors open. Most of the first decade, my husband was working in banking as well, so we were doing it pretty much. He was working full time. Yeah. We had young children, so I was sort of doing all the book work and stuff. And we got a couple of early small export orders, which was good once we got our brand going. And then 4 years ago, we sort of changed the direction a little bit more in that we opened a cellar door facility. So we never had a cellar door, and mainly because we're just so busy with kids and stuff. And yeah. 4 years ago, we went, oh, actually, let's, you know, it's time now. Let's build the cellar door on the property.
Yeah.
And that gives us the opportunity then to get full retail price for the wine. So obviously, if you don't have your own retail outlet, you're only ever going to get the wholesale of the wine or an export price. And so it just gives us a bit more flexibility. And we can make small batches as well. That sort of ties in with our premium sort of brand, that it's not a big deal to make a single batch of, you know, only 500 bottles because we can sell it through the cellar door. Selling wine's really, really hard, essentially. So if you can manage a bit of that yourself, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. That would have been a learning curve as well, like the whole export side of the
everything,
marketing.
Everything was a learning curve. Everything. Wow. So wine exports, you have to get... obviously it's an agricultural product, but it's also an alcoholic product. So you have, you know, liquor licensing issues, you have wine equalisation tax issues, you have export issues, you have to get it, essentially every vintage of wine has to be approved for export from Australia because Australia wants to protect its reputation as a premium. So you have, you have to go through Wine Australia, get approval for the wines you're shipping. You have to get chemical analysis of every bottle of wine because you don't want to, you know, again, you know, the... If you're in China, they don't want chemical residues in the wine. You have withholding periods because it's a food product. So it's a long, drawn-out process. And we have wine in our cellar door that we're selling, which is 2014 vintage, about 6 years ago. I like to say to my grain-growing friends, I said it's like you grow the grain, you harvest the grain, you then bake the loaf of bread and then you put the loaf of bread in the freezer and you don't sell it for 5 years, because that's the equivalent, and that's where the cash flow challenges come in. So we will every year try and have a mix of sell some grapes to some other wineries, so that, because obviously then you get paid at vintage, which is our harvest period. We may also sell some bulk wine, because we might make it into wine and then we might sell it to other wineries. They might have, you know, lost their Cabernet because of a hail event or something like that. And then obviously we sell bottled product as well. So we really try and do that mix. And then one of us has always worked off farm. So obviously it was Matt for many years. And then once our 16-year-old daughter, once she was full-time at school 10 years ago, then I went to full-time work. So every good farming business should have an off-farm income.
That's good advice. So you had your girls and then your youngest went off to school and then you re-entered the off-farm.
Yeah, so I went back to banking, and interestingly, my husband, who had left banking a few years after me, said, "You will hate it. It's changed completely." And it had. It had become so sales focused, and you know, we had that banking royal commission a couple of years ago, where they sort of, you know, really honed in on that sales pressure, and that was really front and center. So that 10 years ago, when I went back into banking, I became really disgruntled really early on, and my biggest concern is that small businesses were being given higher and higher overdrafts. So particularly in the southwest, so people might have retired from being a school teacher or a public servant and had their superannuation in their house, and they, you know, wanted to live the dream and buy a cafe or a, you know, boutique or a giftware shop down south, because that's what everyone wants to do. Business is hard in regional areas. Like, I know down south's a huge tourist area, but you still get to get through long winters. And I got really quite pissed off, actually, that clients were getting I was a small business advisor, but clients were getting basically automatic increases on their overdrafts because the bank held a mortgage on their house and they owned their house outright. And these were businesses that I was saying to people, you know, you need to think long and hard about whether you keep trading, because your business is losing money. And I know you love it, but is this a hobby or is this a business? And you would see people who are basically, you know, eroding their retirement savings, because they were, you know, they might have started with a $10,000 overdraft and then they were getting letters saying, "Oh, we see your overdraft's up to its limit, we'll give you $20,000 because the bank had all the equity in their homes. And so I think I lasted about 16 months in that job, and was really disgruntled. And I actually then saw a job advertised for a national organisation that runs a thing called the Harvest Trail. And over running our own business, we'd use backpacker labour a lot, you know, lots of, we all do in the horticulture sector, viticulture sector. So I'd had lots of experience employing backpackers, working with backpackers, going through some of those issues. And there was a job advertised for the National Harvest Trail. It's run from a not-for-profit out of Victoria, and I applied for the WA State Manager role and got that, and that sort of started, I guess, me on the agriculture workforce development sort of journey.
Yeah. So in 2014, you won the WA Rural Woman of the Year award for your work with refugees. Could you tell the listeners a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as part of this Harvest Trail work, so Harvest Trail it still exists, a federally funded program, helps farmers match up with seasonal workers, which is, you know, where you need people, short term, you know, picking fruit, pruning grapevines. What I saw, though, in that period, in that sort of 2012-13-14, if you remember, it was the peak of the mining boom, and I saw these other businesses using backpackers for essentially permanent jobs. And if you think about the dairy industry, for example, they were operating on a rotating basis of 3-month backpackers to do full-time jobs, because they just couldn't get anyone. There was just a huge shortage of labour. There were other, you know, businesses, other horticulture businesses that also had full-time roles, and they just couldn't get people. There was, everyone was going off to work in the mines. And about the same time, I sort of became aware that we had this whole cohort of resettled refugees, and they were mainly, they were classed as what's called unaccompanied males. So these are people who had arrived by boat. So obviously, we, you know, had that whole period of people arriving by boat, and they were generally young men from Afghanistan or places like that, from Sri Lankans, and they were generally the eldest son or perhaps the husband, and they were refugees because during the whole Afghanistan situation, they were deemed to be anti-Taliban, And so they felt their lives were in danger, but they didn't want to bring their families with them through quite perilous sort of, you know, boat situations. And so either the son or the dad of the family would leave and leave the wife and children behind because they felt the wife and children were safe enough to stay. And I guess the idea is that they would settle somewhere and then get their family out to them. And there's a certain sense of economic refugee as well. But, you know, the people I met, I genuinely felt that they were there, had their lives were in danger. Mm. I worked with a group of Afghan men who had the Australian government had facilitated to come to Australia because they'd been the interpreters for the Australian Army. Mm. And so they were considered, yeah, very much to have their lives in danger. So I had this whole, there was this whole cohorts of young, fit, healthy men. A lot of them had grown up in subsistence farming backgrounds. A lot of them were used to cattling, you know, handling cattle. It might have just been the one cow, but they had animal handling experience. Yeah. And I just sort of thought, just why can't we, we've got this resource of people in Perth, maybe we could try and match them up with jobs. So I got some funding from the WA Department of Multicultural Interests. We ran a very small pilot program where we placed some people into jobs in dairy and horticulture, yeah, got some of them had just got work experience. And I'd run that program, and then as part of the Rural Women's Awards, you get a bursary. So I then went back and did like a short film, took a young filmmaker out, and we did a short film sort of 6 months later. And really good success story. So, you know, the one sort of African guy that was working on a dairy farm in Scott River, when I went back, there was like five African guys working there. He sort of slowly brought his friends back. And yeah. There was the Afghan guy who'd gone up to Carnarvon to work in a banana packing shed. And they were pretty happy when they discovered he was a pretty good cricketer. So a week later he was, you know, bowling for the Carnarvon Cricket Club. And I think they then were even happier when they discovered he was Muslim and didn't drink and he could drive them home. So I did that program, which I loved, but I actually, and people scratch their heads, I actually ran out of people to work with because we had a stop the boats policy. Yes. And then different visa situations changed, and so people who were coming then didn't get work rights, which was a real shame because I was, during that program, I was meeting people where, depending on what date you'd arrived, I might go to a house and there might be six Afghan men living there, and three of them had work rights and three didn't because they'd arrived on slightly different dates and we'd changed the policy. And I'm not going to get into whether the policy's right or wrong, but there was a bit of a lost resource.
Yeah.
But I also realised how incredibly hard the situation is. I had people who were, I didn't understand this. I sent one guy out to the wheat belt and I couldn't understand why he was so fearful, and I then found out afterwards, I was a bit naive, you know. In Afghanistan, you don't go out driving on country roads because you can, you know, there's, you know, there's bombs going off, and there's. He kept saying to me, "Is there any bandits?" And I'm like, "What? Like people who rob me?" And I'm going, "Nah." Like, what are you talking about? You're on the wheat belt.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with a lot of psychological trauma. That it's a really hard thing. And I wouldn't have been in a position to help family groups and things like that relocate. So it's not as simplistic. So I had some good successes, but I also learned a lot of things where some people were actually more comfortable living in cities because they associated wide open spaces as being really dangerous places. Yeah, so I loved the program, but it kind of taught me lots of stuff about individual circumstances. And yeah, so that's how I ended up doing that.
Yeah, and then that sort of kicked off a career now in that workforce development.
Yeah, so at the Rural Women's Awards was really great because it kind of elevates your profile a bit. Mm-hmm. And because I'd spent a number of years working with backpacker labour and then the refugee program and worked across industries, I had a really sort of broad general knowledge of workforce matters across the state. And the not-for-profit group I'd been working for, I was the WANNT manager, so spent a lot of time on the road. I was doing about 55,000 k's a year. I was also working with the seasonal worker program where we bring workers in from the Pacific Islands. So I spent a lot of time talking to farmers about workforce matters. After I won the award, the then Department of Ag, Rob Delane, was the DG then, and he him and I had a chat, and he said something about, you're you know, obviously the state expert in workforce development. I said, "Oh, no, I'm not an expert. and he said, "Oh, well, who else understands workforce development in the state like you do?" And I sort of scratched my head and said, "Oh, probably no one." And he said, "Well, Jackie, you're the expert then." And it was a real, and that's probably a lesson I sort of give to young women, like, your knowledge is really good. Like, don't believe. And I think I'm still carrying that thing of, I never went to uni, so I can't be an expert in anything. I mean, I did sort of studies afterwards. I've done some, you know, a few different things afterwards. But I think I was carrying that burden of, I can't be an expert in this. And that was a real wake-up call that, oh, actually, I do probably know a bit more than most in this space. And at the time, again, we're still mining boom period. It's 2014-15. You know, it was still a huge issue getting... it's ongoing, as we know, with COVID. Ongoing issue getting workers into agriculture. And so I started working on a project through the Chamber of Commerce and Industry WA, but it was funded by DAFWA, to actually work with a lot of industry groups and try and set some things in place, like traineeships and programs. And we did some stuff like getting kids from... So obviously we have ag colleges, but we have another number of schools that have school farms that aren't necessarily fully focused on agriculture. And, you know, Margaret River High School's one where they have a vineyard and they do have kids studying rural operations. But they'd recognised that a gap was they didn't have any livestock there. So we set up a really good program with those kids, and it still goes today. Those kids once a year would go to Muresk and study low-stress livestock handling. Mm-hmm. Because they're in the southwest, they're in a dairy beef production area, mm-hmm. but they're at a school where there's a vineyard, mm-hmm. not cattle. So little programs like that where we try to sort of encourage kids, I guess, into agricultural roles. So, but yeah, so that it was good because the Rural Women's Award didn't create the job, but it lifted my profile to the point where someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, are you interested in running a project? So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Hmm.
You've been involved with the Triple R Network for some time. What do you love about the Triple R Network?
Yeah, so I was on the board of Triple R back when it was a ministerial reference group. So it used to be part of government, and a lot of people don't realise it's no longer part of government. It hasn't been for a little while. But so when it was part of government, we were a ministerial advisory group. And then when I was on the board, and then I was obviously the inaugural CEO once it transitioned to independence. It's the idea that you have a network of women, but you don't have to physically meet all the time. You don't have to necessarily know who everyone is, but it's about this sort of feeling of you belonging, part of a group. I think when it was part of government, that probably wasn't understood well. You used to get sent a magazine, and that kind of meant you were part of it. I think the transition, and you know, it's financially, I think, a bit hard to juggle things for the Triple R. And unfortunately, I was the woman that killed the Triple R magazine, because financially we just couldn't make it work. But I think now with the membership base, you're actually, you know, it's more formalised. You're actually join in actual organisation and getting professional development opportunities or personal networking opportunities no matter where you live. And for those that don't know, the Triple R Network started in 1996, and a lot of people know the lovely Marg Agnew down in Esperance. It was actually her brainchild out of something she'd seen in Victoria, and she lobbied government really hard to create this mechanism. And the magazine was a newsletter, then the magazine. That became a really important communication tool pre-social media, yes, because it allowed people to share stories, and it was always about women standing up and saying, well, I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. And so making women think, oh, well, if she's doing that, maybe I could do something similar. So whether it was starting their own small business or doing something career-wise. And so the medium's changed. Obviously, it's social media and podcasts and wonderful things like that, but mm-hmm. it's still the same message. It's about being the voice of women, but also sharing stories.
In your time as CEO, you know, what were some of your proudest achievements?
I shouldn't say killing magazine because I felt terrible about it, but I had to. So we went from 20 years of being part of a government department where you never had to worry about funding, but we also, that came with it a lot of issues in that you couldn't speak necessarily freely. Not that anyone was telling us not to, but you're part of a government department. You're not. It's not the same as being independent. And so, look, we got some funding to go independent. I'm really proud that it's actually even still going, because it could have quite easily fallen in a bit of a hole. And we had, volunteer board members who really put a lot of work in the early days to actually, you know, just creating a constitution and getting bank accounts and starting websites. So I came along 11 months after it had been incorporated, so the volunteers had sort of kept it safe and held it in their hands for that time. I'm actually just really proud that it's like a fully functioning organisation. So anyone who's been involved in, you know, starting up a not-for-profit or even, you know, your local netball club or footy club knows that there's, you know, the governance stuff is really boring, but it's really important. So it's that creating mechanisms to actually make it work. And then we took on the management of the Rural Women's Awards. So we had two award ceremonies that we organised. We had a major conference. So stuff like that where we were actually able to transition from, oh, well, we're just a magazine and a Facebook page to actually we're a living, breathing organisation that runs events. Some of the stuff I loved, we did a women's leadership training program with Curtin University. Mm-hmm. And that, again, was about us going, right, we want to do a leadership thing, but who's the best at this? And to be able to partner with a university and get them to come to the regions and deliver women's leadership was fantastic. And then another project we ran was an agri-food entrepreneurs program. Which again, we took small businesses who were a bit lost and weren't sure where they were going. And there's some really successful businesses now. So there's a lady who has a whole food market in Katanning who came along and sort of was running this business out of her lounge room and was like, oh yeah, so I'm going to like rent this shop in the co-op. And we're a bit like, is this going to work? But that's gone from strength to strength, you know, food truck out in the wheat belt, things like that. So little things where we're empowering people to step up and build a business or do something different with their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's actually almost embodies what we used to do with the magazine. So in the magazine years ago, we would have told the story. Now the Triple R Network is actually running the programs, running the training courses or the podcasts or the webinars,
yeah,
to actually say this is how you can do it, this is how this mm-hmm. person did it. And inspire a few more women.
And at the time, Triple R was also doing a bit of work around sexism in agriculture as well.
Yeah, and that was, so we really led the charge on gathering data on sexual harassment in rural industries, which was really hard. It wasn't hard getting the data, it wasn't hard getting the stories, and women were incredibly open. What was really hard was people saying, okay, what are you going to do to fix it? And we brought an expert over from Canberra. We ran a training program that we wanted big agribusinesses in WA to engage in. We were going to run it for free.
Yeah.
We ran it for free and we had some great organisations come along, but we could not get buy-in from the major major ag companies in this state.
Yeah.
Didn't want to talk about it at all. And so that was... It was fantastic. We raised awareness. We did a really detailed submission. And Kendall Galbraith, who's now the CEO, she was our researcher at the time. She led the charge on that, did an amazing submission into the Australian Human Rights Commission, who were holding an inquiry into sexism and sexual harassment. And sexism is quite different from sexual harassment. You know, sexual harassment is, you know, quite debilitating for lots of people. And not just women. You know, young men can be subjected to sexual harassment as well. It's an amazing piece of work and it's still an amazing bit of work, but it became quite frustrating that we felt a little bit powerless as a small not-for-profit group to actually do anything other than to raise the awareness. And I, you know, would get interviewed all the time on radio and so what can people do? Oh, well, you know, so what can you do if you're a victim of sexual harassment? Well, you go to your employer first and then you go here and then you have to go here and then you can go to the Australian Human Rights Commissioner. And it's still a really hard process to report.
Yes.
And I think a lot of companies, you know, my message to companies was, you know, if you're doing everything you can to get young women to your organisation because you know you have a gender balance issue, but they're all leaving within a decade and you don't know why, you need to have a really hard look at your organisation, because what generally happens is people will just leave the organisation. And then it'll get a reputation. And there's companies like that in Western Australia where you look at them and you go, you know, there's companies where you look at them and you go, they have a lot of young women up to 35, and then they have a lot of women who are perhaps in their late 50s, and we're all the middle women in between. And it's so they just leave. They just go, this isn't the place for me. So, yeah.
Yeah, that piece of work is something that I've really, I've referred back to a lot over the last couple of years looking at that, and I just, it's so important and poignant, and not enough work, obviously, is getting done on a national level, but I thought that must be something that sticks out to you as being able to have an impact in some way. I know you maybe feel like that you didn't necessarily know what to do next, but
yeah, but even just raising awareness, and sometimes that's enough, and for us to actually go, actually that was enough. And look, I'll tell you a story, and it's pertinent because it's about you know, getting young women into workforce. So my eldest daughter is studying engineering, electrical engineering, quite sought after. It's quite sought after to get young women into electrical engineering. She's going to graduate soon. She is fielding lots of graduate offers because it's a really highly sought after skill. She has companies, you know, buying a coffee, want to talk to her about, you know, coming to work for them. And there's companies where she, as a, you know, 20-something woman, looks at the company and will say, well, hang on, there's no women on the board of that company. So, yeah, the guys I've met are great and I've had a coffee with them, but, yeah, actually, that's interesting. There's no, you know, women on the board there. And the guys, or people I'm meeting are actually... you know, blokes, and they seem really nice. And, you know, she's not a rampant feminist or anything like that, but it makes her think, whereas the company she'll probably end up working for is the one that has, it has a female CEO, it has a, it's a power generation company, it has, there are women in the organisation, you know, line managers and things like that, that are women, where she can see that they are leading the charge, but also she can see that they're achieving work-life balance. She can see women in their 30s who have families. And if you're a younger woman going into an organisation, they, you know, women look at that because they go, if I want to build a career in this organisation, do I want to go into an industry that wants me because it needs to get its gender quota?
Yeah.
And that's fine, and they might be very supportive, but when I look at their higher echelons, and, you know, engineering, there's not as many women. So you know, she's perfectly cognizant that, you know, it's not going to be... The whole workforce isn't going to be 50-50 because there's not as many women. I think she said in her year there's probably 20% are girls. So she's cognizant of that, but it's about that culture, and it's about if we're talking workforce development and we want to get, you know, more young women, and I think there's more young women studying like ag business and ag science, you know, let's think about how we're doing stuff like this. Let's think about what our workplaces are. And as I said, if you're an employer and you're going, why do we have all these women leave our organisation? Then you maybe need to dig a little bit deeper about what's happening actually, you know, at the coalface of your business.
Mm. And just stamping out this idea that, like, it's an aptitude thing. Like, women just aren't fit for agriculture, or it's not, you know, because of physicality or whatever it might be. It's just not a women's industry. But to actually have that data that Triple R gathered to say, well, no, actually, this is how it is, and this is what's going on, and this is story after story after story of people having, women having these experiences.
Yeah, and look, if we think about every job across the agribusiness spectrum, how many of them need physical strength?
Yeah.
Like, I would say very, very few, you know, and that idea that, you know, women can't hack it or they can't do this, or, you know, just stuff that got raised was really basic stuff, like, you know what, having a portable toilet in the paddock if you're a long way from the homestead, you know, like stuff like that. Like, it happens in viticulture. If you have pruning teams, you ring up the Portaloo company and you have the portable toilet there because it's expected. You don't say to anyone, "Oh no, just go have a piss over there."
Yeah.
And I know it's acceptable, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not about men or women, but, you know, let's just have a common courtesy for people and don't just go to these young women, "Oh, well, too bad, you know, this is just what the blokes do."
Yeah.
You know, just really stupid little things like that.
Yeah.
You know, what would you, you know, just some really minimum basic standards, which you wouldn't think you'd have to, you know, have to tell people, but,
apparently we do.
You've had a really diverse and incredible career. Looking back on it so far, what do you feel have been some of the biggest lessons you've learned as a woman working in a farm business and then maintaining your off-farm career as well?
So in a farm business, so I actually now, hand on heart, say I don't get involved in the farm business. So I was certainly involved lots in the bookkeeping side, and from that, and bookkeeping management, staff management. My biggest lesson from that is you're not just the bookkeeper. I just do the books for the farm.
Yeah.
I just do this. I just do, you know, HR, financial management are really integral parts of business.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't mean you're not part of the farm business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just women on farms. I see women who are married to plumbers and electricians who they run their own business. I know, I just do the book work. So my biggest lesson for, you know, in the business is you're not just your partnership, and I think we're getting much, much better at that. And it's probably women my age and older who are, you know, probably, you know, more inclined to have those conversations. "Oh, I just do this, you know, I just make the lunches when we do seeding." Well, that's actually really important. So in business is forget about the just. off-farm career, I actually think, so I'm very much a generalist, so I've taken opportunities as they've come up, and one of the challenges has been building a career when you live regionally, especially in Western Australia, small populations, small organisations. I've been really lucky that I've found positions where I can either work from home or I can spend some time in Perth and some time in at home. But I've also been incredibly lucky that my husband was able to, you know, pick up the gamut of me going, oh, I've got to go, I'm away for 3 days this week, and him being able to, you know, do the, you know, the run to the hockey training and the school bus pickup. So that flexibility, and that flexibility came because he was in agriculture, he was self-employed, he could actually do, have that flexibility. So that's been incredibly important for me to build my career, because there was this recognition that I had to spend a certain amount of time in Perth, unfortunately. Yeah, maybe post-COVID that's changed a little bit, but yeah. It's still, actually, I'm still sort of starting to see it creep back in that I'm in Perth a bit more than I probably need to be. So that... That sort of, you know, WA circumstance where all roads lead to Perth is makes it a bit harder to build a career. And I know lots of women aren't in that position because, you know, their husbands might be FIFO, or their husbands aren't in a position to, you know, have that flexibility to say, well, if you go, if you need to go away for your work, I can, you know, pick up the slack here, you know, with regard to running kids around. So I guess that flexibility, there's also ties into that is, you know, women really need to stop tearing other women down for their choices, because I certainly faced criticism from, you know, other school mums because I was away, and, oh, poor Matt having to, you know, take the kids to netball or hockey, and you go, here's their father. Like, and so that thing of, you know, like, we all make our own personal choices, and just because it's not your choice doesn't mean it's not valid. And so I actually found that probably the most disappointing thing is other women deeming that my choices in life, as in going and having a career off farm and being away a few nights a week from home or whatever, was not a valid choice. So women stopped dragging other women down, and you know, it is hard to build a career regionally, and that's probably the thing I really want to change, is if we can actually make more career opportunities available to people remotely and people across the board, because it actually then it builds our regional communities. And there's so many jobs we can do remotely these days, and wouldn't it be great if our country towns were full of people who were able to generate an income from outside of that town and bring that money back to their local community.
And hasn't COVID really shown us just exactly how many you know, jobs can be done from a...
It has, but I'm kind of, you know, I'm now working in a government agency, and I do find we've kind of gone a bit like, oh, no, but that's all over now, we can all come back. And I sort of said to them, you know, you can't close Pandora's box. People, you've given people this flexibility. But even just people in the city who are going, actually, why was I in peak hour traffic every day? So I think the COVID thing's been great for that. And what we need now is more employers to actually step up and actually say, yeah, we can advertise this job remotely. What I found in the past is employers who had someone working for them that they knew and trusted, if that person then said, by the way, I'm going back to live on the farm, or I'm going to do this, they were supported to do that remotely because that employer knew them and trusted them. It's where there's new jobs, and now I'd love to see that every job was just advertised regardless of location, and I'd love to see that in the public sector, because when you search for jobs in the public sector, they're defined by regions. Yes. I would love to see, there's a policy in New South Wales, it's called If Not, Why Not. Every job must be offered with flexibility and open location. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that in WA, because I think give people the opportunity to explain how they're going to make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I really want this job and I can do it like this. And by the way, I can be in your head office once a week or once a fortnight or once a month or whatever it needs, because it can work, and you're going to get a much bigger range of talent of people applying for positions.
So you are working with the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development now, and you've been working with the government on and off for a really long time. What is it that keeps you so connected to working with the public sector, you think?
Oh, because it's that idea that you can be part of the policy discussion. And so what I mean by that, so my first stint was when I was in this workforce development project, and I was funded by DAFWA and working within CCI, and then that led to a position within the old DAFWA. Which then led to a position in Minister McTiernan's office for the first 8 months of government. It's that idea that, and it sort of comes with, I guess, a bit of confidence that, you know, my ideas are as good as anyone's. You know, my thoughts about what might make the state a better place to do business are valid. And that idea that, I say to my staff, you know, I have this mantra, whenever we're doing anything, I want you to say, is this the best use of taxpayer money? Is this what we should be doing? And so that idea that, you know, it truly is public service, and I know people might sort of roll their eyes at the idea of public servants, but, you know, governments make policy decisions because they get good advice from people, and I really want to be part of that conversation where you can actually say, you know, I think we all see sometimes things where governments make decisions and you go, oh my God, who was advising them on that? And it's not a perfect science, but if I can be part of a conversation where perhaps I can give some insights into living in the regions, working in agriculture, workforce development in agriculture, some of the barriers for small business, because I've got experience in all of that. So it's that idea that I can pass on my lived experience and say to policymakers, maybe we should do things a bit differently, or this is where the pressure points are for businesses. So, so I actually quite like that thought of, being part of the solution, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What does a day in the life look like for you?
Post-COVID or pre-COVID?
Maybe both.
So I started in August last year, and my mantra was, the instruction I was given was to build a team to help small businesses, and we talked about creating an enabling environment, and most of that was around regulatory things. So, you know, I've got an amazing team around me, so I'm very much a generalist, you know, I'm not a specialist, but I know how to tap into those specialist people, and I trust my staff, and I know that, you know, they'll give me great advice. So the team's been focused on a lot of regulatory things. So our agency isn't necessarily the regulator, but we work with, you know, Department of Water and Environment, local government. So if you're going to do a big agribusiness development and you need to, you know, someone's going to assess a nutrient management plan, or, you know, how many head of cattle should be in a feedlot, you know, before it starts interrupting the local waterways and things like that. So, so I've got a team that works and gives advice to other government agencies, but also works with proponents. So there's a lot of conversations with different people juggling all the balls, because people will be going off on different projects, and some are small and some are large. So there's a lot of coordination. So I sort of play that leadership role. There's a lot of sort of feedback loops. Well, should we do this? Should we do that? The team then has expanded a bit, and we're doing a bit more of like true sort of business development. So I guess working more with business proponents, not just on the regulatory side, but also thinking about how they're developing their businesses. The area that I'm in, agribusiness, food and trade, we also have the trade team, we have the food team that includes the Buy West, Eat Best, we have an inbound investment team. And so we can work together to actually say, oh, well, actually, that looks like that's a bit of an export opportunity, let's refer you through.
Yeah.
So again, it's that coordination, talking to people, trying to work out where the best fit is. Mm-hmm. We are trying to, obviously, we've had, you know, machinery of government changes where three agencies have become one. So there's still lots of little challenges around websites and getting communications out. So I'm doing a lot of stuff actually, trying to sort of work out how to get our comms out to say this is what we do. So working a lot with both internal comms, as in dealing with all our other departments. You know, we obviously have amazing scientists and specialists in the agency. So there's lots of conversations across, you know, maybe a head of horticulture or a head of livestock about what we can do, which clients we can support. There's reporting back which clients we're working with, because obviously it's a massive organisation, so we might be working with someone about a particular, you know, development of a piggery, but someone else in our livestock team might be talking to them about something else. So there's a lot of coordination, having lots of conversations.
Yeah.
So it sounds like I get a lot of meetings, which I do. we also, obviously, in the pre-COVID, about 5% of my job was sort of workforce development matters, so I represent WA government on a national ag advisory group, which kind of was just ticking along pretty quietly, and no one seemed overly fussed about it all. And then obviously we had COVID, and that huge reliance we have on overseas workers obviously has put everything in the spotlight. So probably these days I've been spending a lot more time on workforce development, but also helping, you know, advise the minister's office. And obviously when people write to a minister's office, you know, someone needs to do the background and the work behind it, and trying really hard to pull together projects, which obviously Kayla, obviously working with Careers and Grain, has been fantastic, because, you know, it is a huge issue. And, you know, whilst we'd all love to have, you know, our, you know, European backpackers, young, skilled header operators come into the state. It's going to be really hard, and I don't know that it's going to happen because, you know, there's a bigger picture at play. So at the moment, we're really trying to push to get as many Australian kids or the backpackers who are here into training programs and, things like, to work in Oz, Lee Webster's doing to train people up, Muresk are doing a heap of training programs. So this could be an opportunity for us to get more young Australians into this work. And you know, I know the rhetoric is Australians don't want to do these jobs, but I sometimes ask, when was the last time you asked them? When was the last time you went, if you're a farm employer, when was the last time you went to your local high school and explained what the jobs are? It's always going to be hard with seasonal work. It's always going to be hard to get people engaged in work that's 8 weeks, 6 weeks, 6, 8 weeks, 12 weeks long, and then expect people to move on and change locations. But I do wonder if there's a few more full-time jobs out there that we probably haven't really looked at our workforce. And I'm really keen, particularly around the vocational side. So we have so many kids coming out of high schools, both farm schools and other schools, who leave school with a Certificate 2 in agriculture or a Certificate 3 or a rural operations, who then do not get the opportunity to do traineeships. And if you're a farm business, geez, think about putting a trainee on, because there's government subsidies, you get a young person who's interested in your industry. And I think that's been a frustration for many years of mine, is where are we giving opportunities? And there seems to be this chicken and egg stuff. Oh, kids don't want to work in agriculture, but then no one actually comes forward and says, here is the actual job, because people aren't just going to move somewhere on the promise of a job. And we see this with shearers as well. There's been some great shearing training programs, but we still don't have enough shearers in Western Australia, in that we still rely heavily on New Zealand for our shearers. And again, it's that seasonality, but that's my passion, I think, is trying to, how do we get more people into actual permanent jobs in agriculture? And university entrance is great, but let's think about those vocational kids and those kids with really great skills as well.
Because it's going to take everybody of all qualifications to, really move this industry forward and keep it prosperous and fruitful in the years to come.
And I always say, the whole ag sector, not just one particular part of it, but everyone I work with in Western Australia, I call them opportunistic employers. So if someone moves to your town and they can, they have skills you need, whether they can drive a forklift or they've done this, someone will, they'll be in town a week and someone at the footy club will have given them a job.
Yeah.
So we're really opportunistic employers, but because we want people that have got skills.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you go, well, who's given them those skills? And if we as an industry don't step up and say, okay, I'm going to do it, I'm going to take a trainee on, or I'm going to take a graduate on, then how do you build those skills in people? And this idea that, oh, kids don't want to work, well, have we actually given them the chance?
Yeah.
And again, I'll go back, because my eldest daughter's in the job market, as a graduate engineer, the things that those big businesses do to woo graduates, like, they are seriously, rolling out the red carpet. And I know that she's in an area where, she's in high demand, but it's really opened my eyes to what perhaps our industry does as encouraging people. She's had, electricity companies from interstate sending her gift packs, and, her boyfriend's a graduate engineer, working for a mining company. He gets other companies contacting him all the time, with job offers. And I know it's different, but I still get told, oh, yeah, but we need engineers in ag as well. Yeah.
This is the thing, especially in WA, obviously, our young people, they don't know the A to Z of jobs in the resource sector, but they know if they go to uni or they go into a trade that there could be an industry, there's a whole industry there for them that has, this sort of lifestyle, they can expect this sort of wage. And for me, I feel like there's a real missed opportunity there around, kids don't need to know all the exact jobs that they could do in agriculture, but they can understand, and we can show them that there's an industry here with, the lifestyle offering or the pay offering or whatever it might be.
And as well, I don't think we sell the whole package. And so, you know, jobs that have a house included in them. So, yes, we'd like you to move to this town, but guess what? We're going to give you a house and we're going to give you a car. And we don't promote that enough. So there are opportunities there that we, as I said, we're really opportunistic employers. So someone comes to town, you go, oh, that person would be great. And, you know, we do it in our business, you know. We need someone in the cellar door. My husband's going, oh, such and such has moved to town. He's a teacher, but his wife, she'd be really good in the cellar door. And, you know, we do that. And it's human nature, I guess. But how do we connect with those kids if they're not, you know, going to rock up at the footy club? And how do we roll out the red carpet and say, look, this is the opportunity? And this idea that people are just going to move to country towns, you know, and then we'll employ them, you know, that happens very, very rarely. So let's actually think about what our offering is. And I get it, it's really hard as well, because the other thing is we're an industry dominated by small business and we don't have specialist HR skills. And so I get that it's really hard. And sometimes you're a little bit fearful about, if I get a trainee, and what are my obligations and what do I have to do? So we probably need to do more around, you know, as a government, I guess, you know, state and federal, about what does this mean? What support are we giving to employers to actually connect to people? Because, we need to get more kids into agriculture, but we've got to just stop talking about it. And each individual business needs to be part of the solution, because, you know, we're not going to get people from overseas this year. I don't know what's going to happen next year. And I get that there's seasonal jobs, but, you know, I think if a lot of farm businesses looked really hard, they might find that they actually had an entry-level position that they could operate all year round.
Yeah. What's your sense that industry is really grasping what the employment challenges are going to be as a result of COVID?
That they think it's going to be business as usual, and it's not. Look, you know, I don't work for the federal government. I have no sense of whether the federal government will let people come in to work, but I get queries every day from people saying, well, I just want this one person to come from New Zealand because he drives my header for me, or I just need these 5 shearers to come from New Zealand, but I've got this great guy in Germany, you know, he comes every year, and so what's the forms I need to fill in, what I need to do to apply to the federal government? And I'm happy to give them the advice, but, you know, I kind of say, maybe look at the media stories. We've got people who can't visit dying relatives, who cannot get into the country. We had a woman last week in the news who came to Western Australia to be with her dying father, and her father died before she got out of a 14 days quarantine. Like, these are really heartbreaking stories. And I think there's a little bit of arrogance from our sector to say, yeah, but my job, I'm feeding the world. It's really important. Yeah. We get that. But I just don't feel like we're in a position at the moment with what's going on that people want to take the risk or take the chance. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, whilst the federal government on their website says if it's a highly critical specialist skill, there could be an opportunity for people to come to Australia, I don't know how that's going to work. And I just feel like let's not put all our eggs in that basket, you know, because who knows? Things might change, but they might change. And I think the Victorian situation has shown us how quickly things can change, because I think there was a recognition that this current outbreak in Victoria has come from someone overseas. And yes, there were lots of things that broke down and we've all seen it in the media, but it scared the horses somewhat in that. I think it's going to be really hard, and I think people need to actually really stop and think about, you know, it's not just as simple as filling in a form and they're going to let someone come in from overseas, unfortunately. And, you know, there's lots of things, you know, my elderly father, you know, can't get back to Ireland to visit his 90-year-old sister. You know, like, there's lots of people having really challenging times. And I don't think saying, you know, I'm growing food, it's really important, is actually going to change things, unfortunately, which is, it's hard, and lots of businesses are suffering, but we just have to try and work out a way to get through it.
Yeah. Jackie, the last question we always ask is, if anyone has connected with your story and would love to know more about you, where can they go to find out more, or how can they get in touch with you?
So LinkedIn, probably, Jackie Jarvis. I'm on Twitter, which is Jarvis_Jackie, and the Jackie is J-A-C-K-I-E. So send me a message on those two. I'm work at DPIRD, so I have the stock standard, you know, jackie.jarvis@DPIRD email address, you know, what is it? deeper.wa.gov.au. So happy to have a chat.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been so nice to sit down with you. Jackie and I have been working via Zoom together for a couple of months, and so it's so bizarre to sit here and have a face-to-face.
I know, it's good, especially on a Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kayla. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to the Triple R Network podcast by Generation Ag. Stay tuned for another episode in this series in a fortnight's time.